The European Leadership Forum is a bridge between local Christian leaders' needs and God's global resources. Hundreds of hours of focused Christian thinking are available from teachers like Ravi Zacharias, Don Carson, and William Lane Craig. Go to www.euroleadershipresources.org to find out more and to sign up to our monthly email highlighting resources that can support your ministry.
Friends, I think we'll make a start. I hope we'll make a start. I'm going to try to make a start.
Stop talking now. Thank you.
I'm taking a leaf out of Nick Nadelchev's book and taking an authoritarian line. Thank you very much. Okay. Just before we start, let me pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for this time together as a network. Thank you for the opportunity to hear our brother Nick talking about this grand vision for European evangelical leadership. Lord, we want to do your will, and we want to find the best ways of doing that. I pray now, Lord, that you'll use my talk to help us to think in some depth about what leadership and management are about, and particularly in this context. Lord, I pray that it may be useful to those of us who are here, that it will be of value, and that people will be able to take something away from it and apply it actually in their ministries and lives and leadership challenges at home. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay. My talk is really focusing on what I have perceived to be the commonest management mistakes in my years of working with a number of different people and organizations. There are many Christian organizations, churches, foundations, schools, blessed with fine leaders, extraordinary leaders, many of them, men and women of vision, energy and drive and commitment, and tremendous spiritual stature often, and often charismatic and energetic and magnetic personalities, which is wonderful. God uses such people to achieve astonishing things. You and I can probably testify to some of them that we've seen. What I find challenging, though, is that sometimes things go badly wrong, even for great visionary leaders. I've worked with a number over the years, and I can recall a number of occasions when we have hit rocks that would have otherwise been avoidable. Why should that be? Surely the whole point about a great leader is that he should see these things coming. Well, sadly, great leaders, I believe, are sometimes deficient in some key areas of management. I must say, though, that in the cases of Christian leaders I've worked with, they've always been humble enough to listen to criticism and to encourage some feedback from me, even though it may have been unwelcome and unpleasant, even, in some cases. The fact is that charisma and vision and drive are wonderful things, but we need some management skills to harness them. Management's had a bit of a bad press in recent years. Witness the ad in the Wall Street Journal that says, let's get rid of management. If you want to manage somebody, manage yourself. Do that well and you'll be ready to stop managing and start leading. Well, yeah, it sounds great. It's a terrific ad, I must say. But John Cotter, who I had the privilege of studying under at business school, and who I think is one of the great gurus of leadership these days, says leadership is about coping with change and management is about coping with complexity, which says to me that both are actually necessary, that both are needed, that you need leadership to lead change and you need management to manage complexity, because all of us are involved both in the change business and in organizations and tasks that are complex. Over the previous few months, as I've been thinking about this topic and talked to other people, I've identified 9 problems that I would classify as management problems, which this morning we're going to look at and figure out how to try and avoid. There may well, quite honestly, be 99, or even 999. This is work in progress, as I'm actually working on trying to see whether this will make a book that I'm going to work on with a psychologist friend of mine. So feedback is more than welcome. I'd love to hear from you in the form of disagreement or agreement. And if you have some good anecdotes that illustrate some of these things, I will be eager to hear them. My purpose... is to be helpful rather than to be critical. We all fall short in one way or another. We are all sinners. And I am not pointing the finger at anybody, any one person. I freely admit to having made and still do make most of these mistakes from time to time. So if you identify with something that I say, don't despair. The skills are learnable and not something you are or aren't born with. It's something we can do something about. Okay, without further preamble, I don't have Christine to stop me doing an introduction, but I do have my wife here who I think I'd better stop introducing and get on with the work. First of all, problem number one, what I've called eyes and nose. I'm sorry, I'm British. I cannot resist the occasional pun, and this is a pun. Just for clarity's sake, for those of you who are not native English speakers, this is a pun on eyes and nose. But it's also because we need to see and smell clearly what we're talking about here. What's the problem here? Well, it's the tendency of leaders to surround themselves with people who agree with them and to see those who disagree as inconvenient nuisances. We have a bank in the UK, HSBC, a big worldwide bank, which acquired an English bank called Midland Bank some years ago. The Midland Bank had a great advertising slogan. It called itself the bank that likes to say yes. But actually, although it might have been a very good advertising slogan, I want to ask whether a bank that likes to say yes is actually the best place to put your money, or even perhaps to borrow money from. It may say yes to the wrong people and to the wrong projects. It might even say yes to you when it ought to say no, because that might stop you going in a wrong direction. And that's really the purpose of having people around us who will challenge us, question our decisions, and ask us to explain ourselves more fully. You see, as leaders, we need this kind of tough treatment to stop us from thinking that we have all the answers. Some of the things that Nick was saying in our previous talk, I just identify so much with this area of thinking. The need to have people around you to disagree and to challenge. That's what governance, which is one of today's buzzwords, that's what governance is all about. That's why we need to have boards of trustees, directors, whatever, to question us, to probe, to make us uncomfortable rather than to reassure us and make us feel good. At Emmanuel University, where I have the privilege of teaching, we have a few people who are advisors in different ways. And in particular, one British man and one American, who are probably the most tough questioners that I have ever had to deal with. They can make life really difficult by asking tough questions. But they are a godsend. My boss, Paul Negroots, listens to them. And when they start asking questions, he feels an obligation to answer. And there can be nothing more healthy than that. It's healthy to have rigorous questioning and probing into our ministries. It does have to be said, in this area of disagreement and saying no and so on, that there are people who are just malicious critics. We can put it that way. They're negative. They always say no. And that's not the right thing either. A pastor of a church will often come across people like this. People who write or who phone or who speak to say how much they disagree with your sermon or how wrong your choice of an elder might be. How do we tell good disagreeers from bad disagreeers? Well, Bill Hybels of Willow Creek Church says the ultimate question is, do they share the vision? Do they share the vision? Do they agree with you on what the end point is, what the point of arrival is? Is it their passion as it is your passion? Because if it is, then you should listen to them very carefully and take note of what they're saying, because they may have something of great value to pass on. If they don't share the vision, if their vision is something completely different from yours or your leadership team's, then probably the right thing to do is to listen politely and move on. So, what are we going to do about this one? Well, let me give you some thoughts just for analysis. I'll try to do this on each point to give you just some quick ideas of how you analyse where you stand on this. Let me give you a few thoughts on this. First of all, look around you at your present circle of advisors and friends, board members, lieutenants, and so on. Do they often, sometimes, seldom, or never disagree with you? You see, if it's seldom or never, then maybe you need to add some people who will disagree with you deliberately. Second, are your meetings a monologue? You speaking. A serial dialogue. First you and one person, then you and another person, then you and another person. Or are they a discussion where people can join in, where people can argue with each other without having necessarily to involve you? See, if it's a dialogue, if it's a monologue or a serial dialogue, maybe you need to figure out how you add some debate, discussion and conflict to your meetings. Thirdly, what was the last time you took somebody's advice? Fourthly, how do you feel about outsiders? Maybe people from outside your country, outside your ministry perhaps, coming and giving you some advice or questioning you. Is your instant reaction, they should mind their own business? Or do you want to welcome outside views? Second, some action points. Think about people whose minds and abilities you respect. People with whom you do believe you share the ultimate vision of where you're going, but who aren't part right now of your circle of advisors. Maybe somebody that you've had a good conversation with. You might want to think about them. Talk to them. They may share the vision, but they may not agree with how you're going about achieving it. Well, that's got some real value and could cause us to reflect and think about that. Thirdly, think about your visitors, especially those of us in Eastern Europe. Think about your visitors from abroad. Those who share the vision with you could bring a fresh and valuable perspective, but you have to listen to them. Consider having an advisory board of such people. Nick did talk about an executive board, but there's some value also in an advisory board. People who have no particular stake in what you do, but who are wise people, because they can question and ask you things. The more fresh air that we can bring into our leadership, the more transparency, the more openness to discussion, the better it'll be. Let me move on. Second mistake that I've seen is present pleasure, future pain. Basically, none of us like to be bearers of bad news. We don't like to disappoint people. We don't like to make them angry. So we just don't say anything as often as not. We hope the problem will go away. Folks, that's natural enough. And it's not unique to Eastern Europe, although it is common in Eastern Europe and Asia and Africa. But it's common to everybody. Nobody really likes bringing bad news. The trouble is, it can cause a great deal more trouble if it's put off, if it's deferred, than if it's tackled now. Let's suppose I come to you and I ask you for some advice, thinking back about the last topic. I ask you for some advice on a particular topic. You're glad I asked for the advice because you've got some strong opinions about how things should be done. So you think about it, you take some trouble, you reflect, and then you give me your considered advice. I don't debate with you particularly about it. I listen, and then we go our separate ways. And a little while later, you discover that I've actually gone in a completely different direction from what you advised. In fact, you went in the opposite direction. You did the opposite thing. Oh, I did the opposite thing. How do you feel as a result of that? How do you think you feel? Well, I know how I would feel. I would probably feel frustrated, at least, annoyed that I'd taken some trouble and not been heeded. I would certainly be upset in various different ways. But in the end, you probably shrug and say, well, okay, it's their decision. It's his decision. He didn't take my advice, but that's okay. He wasn't obliged to do so. It wasn't compulsory. Maybe he had reasons for ignoring me. That's perhaps a charitable view. However, how willing are you going to be to give me advice next time I ask? Well, not very. Come to that. How are you going to feel about trusting me in the future? Again, not very much. It would be true to say, I think, that our future relationship has been seriously damaged. And that we will not easily regain the ground that I've lost, and I'm going to be the poorer for that. But you know, when we come right down to it, what was really the problem? Was the problem that I didn't take your advice, or was the problem rather that I never took the trouble to explain to you why I wasn't taking your advice? I might have had some good reasons. There might have been some things you didn't know about which I had to take into account. And that the decision was a justified one, to go the opposite way. But I never took the trouble to tell you. Why not? Well, because I didn't want to upset you. I didn't want to tell you, thanks for your advice, but I've decided to go the other way, for this reason, that reason, or the other. Instead, I just kind of went the other way and hoped you wouldn't find out, at least for a good long time, by which you'd have forgotten about it. What a dumb hope. Really. Why would I not tell you I decided to go the other way? Simply because I didn't want to break some bad news to you. Over and over, I find that people shrink from giving bad news. It's partly cultural, as I said. Partly we try to find kinds of ways just to avoid issues and not to confront it openly. And that's why I call it present pleasure, future pain. We avoid pain now by not telling somebody something, but we store up for ourselves a much worse pain further down the line. It's a battle between what the psychologists call instant gratification and deferred gratification. When I first came to Emmanuel University some 7 or 8 years ago, we didn't have any sort of representation of our own in the United States, where donors could give funds for support. So we worked through a mission organization, very decent people, kind people, who accepted donations on our behalf and sent the money to us when we needed it to pay our expenses. Very helpful, good people. But the problem was they were doing that for a number of different people, and occasionally problems would arise. Maybe they would take our list of donors and send a mailing of their own to everybody, and that was awkward at times and not what we wanted them to do, and the donors didn't like it much. So a number of donors, and especially some key donors, urged us to get our own 501c3 charity, non-profit organization. So we started to do that. We asked some people to help us, and we started to set it up. And I just mentioned it to the president of this mission organization, and he flew into a temper and said that we shouldn't do that, that they were coping perfectly well with what we were doing. So I kind of backed off. I didn't say anything more. But we continued to try to put this organization of ours into place. If ever you've done that in the States, you'll probably know that it takes a long time. It takes about 2 years, really, to bring it to fruition, two and a half years. So for 2.5 years, nothing much happened. And then we got the good news that it was all granted, authorized, and so on. And we were ready to start going. And we told one of our key donors about this. So they were very pleased. They wanted to give us a donation to help pay for a building that we were building. Quite a substantial donation. So they sent the check. They issued the check. Only, unfortunately, the secretary of the person that was sending it sent it to our charity, but at the address of the mission organization. And when the mission organization called up and said, "Oh, you've put it in the wrong name," she said, "Oh, no, now Emmanuel University has its own charitable organization, its own foundation." Well, you can imagine the kind of furore that resulted. They were hurt and miserable and unhappy that we, and there, it was a complete loss of trust, obviously. And we hadn't meant to be untrustworthy. We hadn't meant to be deceitful. We'd just not liked the reaction we got the first time, and so we'd kind of avoided the issue. How much better if we'd said, "Brother, we believe that the time has come when we've got big enough and ugly enough that we really need to have our own organization. You've been wonderful to us. Thank you for all you've done. But as of 3 months from now, we are going to transfer our activities to our own organization. We've grown up." How much better? Even if he'd been angry, it wouldn't have been a breach of trust as he perceived it. How much better if we'd done it that way? If I'd done it that way, how much better? Let's analyze it for ourselves. How good are you at confronting issues? When was the last time you broke bad news to somebody? And how timely was it? Did you delay a long time before you passed it on? Let's try a test case. Imagine somebody invites you to go somewhere where you really don't want to go. Come for dinner somewhere you don't want to go. Do you say, "No, I'm sorry, I won't be able to come on that date, I've got something else on"? In which case they then say, "Oh, how about the week after? What day would suit you in the week after?" So you say, no, "I'm sorry, I really can't come." So they say, "How about Thursday next week?" And you say, "Well, maybe I might be able to manage Thursday. I don't know. Let me get back to you." And on Thursday, when you don't show up, they phone or they call around to see what's gone wrong. I had that happen to me 2 weeks ago. So I'm still not practicing what I preach as I should. How much better if I said, "I'm really sorry, but I don't think this is something that we can do. Thank you. Thanks for the invitation, but no, we won't come." Hard to do, but the right thing to do ultimately. So the action is quite simple. Confront. Deal with it. Now. Not some point in the future. It doesn't have to be we don't have to be rude, unpleasant, or disagreeable. But I believe what we have to do is be upfront. Now, again, culturally, Nick will say, be careful here. Culturally, this may not be appropriate. Well, I think that this is a change that we can gradually start to make if we do it in the right way. It's not so much what we do as how we do it. And my recommendation is we try to do that. Let's skip on to point three. The all-rounder. Some of these quotes I love. My boss spent the entire weekend retyping a 25-page proposal that actually only needed corrections. She claims the disk I gave her was damaged and she couldn't edit it, but the disk I gave her was write-protected. And that's the chief information officer of Dell. Makes me worried about my computer at this point. Leaders sometimes think that because they're the leader, they are supposed to know everything about everything to do with the organization. Isn't that true? I mean, look inside your heart yourself. If I look inside mine, I find that. My father, he used to run a trucking company in Africa. He knew engines and cars and trucks very intimately. He knew what made them tick. But when he became a Christian, he spent some 5 years running the company, but he then decided to leave and to become ordained and became a vicar, a pastor in Africa. One day, he was driving along with his bishop in the car, the big boss. And so they were driving through the countryside, and as so often in those days, the car broke down. So my dad gets out and he opens up what we would call the bonnet and others would call the hood and starts to figure out what it is that's gone wrong. He's probably got a shrewd idea that it's the carburetor or whatever it is. The bishop also gets out of the car and comes and looks into the engine and starts to give my dad advice on what he should be doing. And it's very clear from the advice that he knows absolutely zip about engines. But because he's a bishop, he felt that he ought to be able to tell what was the matter. I mean, maybe he could have laid hands on it, I don't know. But whatever it was, he thought he knew, and the fact, of course, is that he didn't. How many leaders think that because they're at the top of the organization, they need to be on top of every job? That they have to know the details of everybody's job. Well, we need to learn to allow other people to be good at their jobs without us as bosses having to be as good as they are at those things. It does help to know how to ask the right questions, but we don't have to have the right answers to everything because all we need to know is where can we get the right answers. The chief executive, the leader, the president of an organization, obviously should have at his or her fingertips four or five key elements about the organization. What's the vision? What's the strategy? What are the key elements for this year? What things are we going to be doing this year? How many people do we have in the organization? And so on. But apart from that, we need to learn where and how to get the information, rather than thinking we need to know it all perfectly. We need to be able to have the humility to say, quite honestly, I don't know the answer to that question, but I can find it out and I'll get right back to you. There's nothing wrong with that. There's everything wrong with either taking a flying guess at what it might be or trying to pretend that we know it without doing so. I remember an occasion when a potential investor asked the chief executive of an organization I was working with how many customers they had. Well, he couldn't actually remember how many customers they had in this particular area. So he did remember about 3 or 4 years ago what the number was. So he took the number from 3 or 4 years ago and multiplied it up a bit and said, with great confidence, such and such a number. Unfortunately, a short while later, the chief financial officer was asked the same question, and he replied with the accurate number, which was about 30% less than the chief executive had given. The result was the investor didn't trust anything that that chief executive said ever again, because he figured that he'd been inflating the number deliberately so as to take him in. Basically, it comes down to knowing what really is important to your job and what should be left to others to be good at. Ask yourself, what questions do I really need to be able to answer? If the answer is everything, you've not been listening. If there's a question that you don't know the answer to whom would you turn in order to get the answer? Is it a question that's crucial to how you do your job, or is it actually just one of those things that you'd like to know that somebody might ask you at some point? Can we cheerfully admit to not knowing the answers, recognizing we have competent people who do? And can I be comfortable with the idea that I can be on top of my job without being best at everything that everybody else does in the organization? If when you go through those analysis questions you find you're actually anxious if you don't know everything, then you're being a bit like the bishop with my dad in the car. You think you have to know how to fix the car, but actually you just need to take some deep breaths and change the way you think, to trust people who are competent to deal with these things, to let them do it. If necessary, quite honestly, if you do have some complexities that are hard to keep in mind and they are important that you know, why not carry a simple cheat sheet of some kind? Either a piece of paper with key data on them that you keep in a file of fax or whatever it is you carry. I carry a Palm, which I find incredibly useful just for keeping key files and information on, so I can look it up. And then I don't have to trust this faulty memory of mine. Much more effective. And learn, most of all, to ask good questions rather than to expect yourself to have good answers to everything. That's when we're really on top of the job. Fourthly, what I call the Indian giver. It's an expression that I've learned from Americans. It's probably not politically correct nowadays, since what we used to call Red Indians are supposed to be called Native Americans, I think, or original inhabitants, or whatever it is. At any rate, for the benefit of us Europeans, an Indian giver is someone supposedly who gives something to you and then takes it back at once. Is that accurate? Well, in this case, it reminds me of a story of a leader who gave me responsibility for doing something, for handling finance and accounting. And the head of accounting from there on was to report to me, and I would look after that area of the operation. It worked fine. But then I found out that actually, whenever he wanted an update on the financial situation, he didn't call me, he called the chief accountant. And it was natural then, if he had questions and got answers, then he would then give the chief accountant instructions as to what to do about the answers. And pretty soon I found that actually I was completely unnecessary in this loop. Well, that's the Indian giver approach to delegation. You give it and you take it away. The person to whom the delegation's been to whom the authority's been delegated is damaged because they feel left out of the loop. The delegation, as far as they're concerned, is a sham. It's a pretense. The person who's delegated the authority is also damaged because they now have the burden of both a disillusioned subordinate, somebody who's disappointed and feels let down, and they still have the responsibility that they tried to give away it's still a burden on their back. And it also damages the area which was supposedly delegated, in my case, the finance and accounting area. Assuming that it involves people, as it usually does, they are now confused. Who is the boss or the boss? Do I try to please both? Well, the Bible's pretty clear about trying to please two masters, and it's going to be difficult. So what do we do about it? Well, first of all, delegation has to be done in the right way and to the right people. If you were in my seminar pre-forum yesterday, you'll remember that there's a right time and a wrong time to delegate. There's the right needs and the wrong needs. Assuming that the person is qualified to have something delegated to them, then we can safely leave them the responsibility and make the decisions the way we would want them to. Sometimes people take back delegated powers because they just don't like the feeling of losing control. Sometimes they justify taking back the delegated authority because somebody's made a mistake. They're punishing, effectively, the mistake. And that's why I quoted Max Dupree here. One of the things we need to understand better is the role of grace. Mistakes are not terminal. They're part of education. The problem is, if we take back the authority from somebody who's made a mistake, we're missing some good opportunities. The opportunity to teach from the mistake and the opportunity to benefit from their learning from the mistake. I remember an occasion when somebody made a mistake in our organization and they'd been delegated the authority to do this thing, and they had to tear down everything that they'd done and start as a punishment, effectively, and they lost the authority to do it anymore. Well, no surprise, they'll never take an independent decision again. No surprises there. We have to allow mistakes to occur in our organizations. We use mistakes to teach, not to blame, condemn, and punish. Better to teach and then empower to go on. There's a great story about Tom Watson Jr., the legendary chief executive of IBM. He had a senior manager at IBM who had been responsible for a product decision, which was a bad one, and it cost IBM millions of dollars. They had to write off a lot of things. It was just a big mistake. Well, at the end of this episode, he was summoned to meet Tom Watson and to explain what had happened. So he went to Tom Watson. He had the uncomfortable hour or whatever it took, explaining what had happened, why it had happened, what had gone wrong, and so on. And at the end of the hour, Watson called the meeting to a close and stood up and shook hands with this manager and said, fine, case closed. The manager was amazed. He said, I expected to be fired. Watson said, we can't afford to fire you. We've just spent millions of dollars on teaching you a very important lesson. We now want to have the benefit of that lesson in our organization. So go off and do good. Delegation. The leader who fails to delegate firmly and clearly, or who delegates and takes that authority back, is missing an incredible opportunity for leadership. The sharing of power, which Nick was talking about earlier. Let's not try to miss that opportunity. How about standing up and taking a stretch? You can even massage the person next to you's shoulders if you want. But shall I put the air conditioning back on for a bit? Okay, let's press on. I'm cutting as far as I can. As I said, this is work in progress. Sorry about this. I'm trying not to write the book here as we go, but I'll keep it as clean as I can. Too busy to stop being busy. I never forget an occasion that my wife described to me some years back when she used to get consulted every year about the reception that we used to have for graduation, where we had all the graduates and their parents and various dignitaries that would come. We'd have a big reception with buffet and finger foods and so on and speeches, and it was a celebration for the graduates and their parents. And Anne always used to get asked to advise and consult. It was before she actually got to take the thing over. But she was there as an advisor or consultant. And she describes how she went into the kitchens in the afternoon when the reception was being prepared. And there was the head chef, a guy. He was arranging in beautiful patterns on the platters pieces of cold meat and the various things you do for finger food. He was arranging them, and around him were standing five members of staff of the kitchen, all standing and watching while he did this. And the expression on their faces was tragic. There they were. They had hands and minds available to do the same thing. But he wasn't letting them. He wanted to do it. He was the only one qualified to do it, and he was going to do it. And the only thing they could do was take the platter and put it on a table. No surprise that the food wound up being very late for the reception, and by the time it was served, most of the people had gone home. That's what happens to many leaders. They have so many tasks that they think they're the only ones that can do it. So many responsibilities. It's all they can do just to keep them going. Do you know those guys, the conjurers, who they have plates that spin on rod. They have these rods and the plates that spin, and you set them off going. You've got four or five or six right across the stage, and you spin them, and then you see this one slowing down. You have to come over, spin this one, and then back over to spinning this one. That's a picture of leaders who do this kind of thing. Too busy to stop and figure out, how do I stop being so busy? Recognize anything of yourself here? Well, join the club. I certainly do. How do we break out of it? Well, first of all, recognize what's happening. Look at how you are spending your life. And ask yourself, is this really what you want? Is it what the Lord wants of you? Think about the mission to which you've been called. Are you fulfilling it? Or are you doing a lot of jobs? What straightforward tasks could you hand over to somebody else? What things don't require only you to do it? I know one leader who handed over two things to an assistant that up to then he'd thought that he was the only one that could do it. His appointments diary and his email. He said, from now on, you're in charge of the appointments diary. If somebody wants an appointment with me, I am not going to give them an appointment. They have to come to you. And you will sort it out. And I will simply follow what you do during my working day. The second thing was, he said, email. I want the email. I want you to pick up all my email. He created a second email address, just a very private one, which the assistant could send emails to that really required his personal attention, or to which his very closest associates could send confidential stuff if they needed to. He gave those two things away, which up to then he jealously guarded. And it transformed his life. Just two things. Transformed the way he ran his office and his life. You can just imagine. So often, I find as well, and this is particularly true, I think, in Romanian culture. Brothers, please excuse me if this rings true, but in Romanian culture, so often maybe in your own culture too, I don't know, Lithuanian or others in Eastern Europe, people come to the boss to ask the boss not just for permission to do something, but also expect the boss to give the ideas on how it should be done, what the content should be, and so on and so forth. In other words, they come with a blank sheet of paper and ask the boss to fill it in, essentially, figuratively speaking. And by doing that, they create two frustrating situations. One, they put the monkey on the boss's back to do something. And secondly, they then have to wait for ages for him to get around to doing it. Doesn't make sense. Instead, it's a golden opportunity, I think, for the boss to change the way that things are done. For the leader to say, when you come to me, don't come to me with a blank piece of paper. Come to me with a plan, an outline plan. I'll criticize it if necessary. I'll suggest changes. But come with a plan. Or if you want me to write a letter to somebody, which has to go out in my name, okay, but don't come to me and ask me to write the letter. Come to me with the letter, and I will amend it if I think it's necessary, or if I don't agree with it, I won't send it. I have reserved the right to do that, but come to me with a draft letter, and I will change it if necessary. Imagine the amount of time and opportunity that is saved when we do that. Instead of the boss just being the only brains in the organization, he's coupling together brains from all over the organization. Now, he's not relinquishing all right. He does want to see it. He wants to be able to approve final plans, perhaps. And that's if it's serious enough, he should. But at least he's not the only brains in the organization. What a difference it might make. You might, incidentally, consider, if this point really strikes you as being important, you might want to consider attending my seminar on time management this afternoon. Or perhaps not, just as you choose. Number six, staying out of touch. Leaders often have great ideas. They think about them, and they dream about how wonderful things will be when their idea comes to reality. And within a short space of time, they think they're already halfway there, before they've even talked to anybody about it. And the result is they're disappointed when people don't show the same level of enthusiasm for their idea as they themselves had. Why is it that communication is so often the area where leaders fall down? Well, I don't think I've been in a single organization where I've heard people say things like, well, above all, in our organization, we have really excellent communication. I don't think I've ever heard that once. On the contrary, when you ask people what things are wrong with your organization, nearly always communication is the problem. I remember some years ago, when our church leaders in London organized a team of people to visit everybody in the church, everybody who was a member of the church, to visit them. They were to talk to them, listen to them, get their input on what was going well in their view and what wasn't going well. But it was a useful exercise and quite helpful for planning purposes. But ironically, you know what the number one complaint was? Communication. And interestingly, leadership teams who regard themselves as who are regarded as not communicating well nearly always think that they're terrific at communicating. They point to their various efforts. They declare that they're being criticized unfairly. But the fact remains that in the opinion of those who want to be communicated with, they're falling short. What's the problem? I suggest there are three. People who are not in the immediate circle of the leadership group always feel they're being left out. They're sure that there's something going on that they don't know about, that they ought to know about, that there are plans afoot, maybe that will affect them in some way, but they don't know what that is. Second, people have very high expectations of their leaders, that they could and should communicate much better. And so when those expectations aren't met, people feel disappointed and let down, and they complain about communication. And thirdly, people sometimes feel as if they're just always the last people to find out. Somehow, in every organization, there's always somebody who is first to find out about something, but somehow we always feel as if we're the last to find out. That sense of knowing, of not knowing something when other people do, is very uncomfortable for people. Whatever the cause, and whatever you may think, the 99% probability is that people in your organization think that communication is not good in your organization. So what can we do about it? Well, first of all, don't despair. Everybody can improve. And I've got some suggestions for you. First of all, we tend to think that communication just involves speaking or writing. But actually, as much as anything else, it involves listening. Listening to people is half the battle. So we need to find opportunities to do that. People want to be listened to have the means of expressing their wishings or longings or frustrations. So we need to give them a channel for doing that. How can we do that? Well, certainly at American Express, one way I used to do it, to try to be in this kind of a situation, was to have a lunch once a week with 10 or 12 people from just about anywhere in the organization. Managers, people who worked on the front line, people from different areas of the operation. And just sit there. We had lunch together. We could talk about anything, but I would say that there were no holds barred as far as asking questions were concerned. If I could answer them, I would. If I didn't know the answer, I would try to find out the answer. And that was the basis of the discussion. And I tried to be open and communicate effectively in that. It's amazing the impact of food in our church. We have a saying, with everything, give food. And it's amazing. Just eating a sandwich with somebody kind of loosens the tongue. And loosening the tongue is what we want to do. So, first, open a channel. Second, electronic communication gives us some extraordinary opportunities now, which we didn't used to have. Email is such a wonderful communication medium. It is informal in itself. It's an informal means of communication. So it's a bit like speaking. But because it's written, it enables somebody to look at it, to read it, to digest it, and then maybe to respond to it. So you actually get that two-way communication. I remember at American Express the extraordinary breath of fresh air that a new chief executive brought in, Harvey Golub, when he sent an email to everybody in the company. That would be about 110,000 people at that time. He sent an email to everybody. And it was a chatty kind of email, talking about plans and problems. And it was open. It was the first time that people had really been communicated with like that. And it was like a breath of fresh air. And you and I can do that, even on the smallest scale, because virtually everybody now has email. The question is, have you got their addresses? And that's a challenge to us too. Above all, as leaders, what we need to do is what we call MBWA in the management jargon, management by walking about, MBWA, which means actually just being there. Means getting out from behind the desk, from behind the computer, and walking around in the organization. Now, I want to try and wind this up fairly quickly because I'm overrunning here. I'm going to take 7, 8, and 9 at a fast clip. I'm going to shorten them a bit and just to give you a summary because I do want to give you time to ask questions. We have about half an hour left of the time, so I do want to give you opportunities to debate or discuss. So I will take this last bit rather faster. Not speaking faster, but trying to shorten what I'm saying. Amateurs have more fun is basically saying, why try to do things professionally when you can get away with just doing them the first way that comes into your head? It's a rhetorical question. It's a mistake. I believe that in non-profit organizations, and in particularly in Christian organizations, we seem to have got the idea fixed in our heads that it's sinful to spend money on things in order to do them well. So we do our best to save money in every direction. The result is that everything we do can wind up looking second rate and low quality. You'd think that I would know better because I spent a long time in a very professional marketing organization, American Express, a company which knows no limits when it comes to design, artwork, and visual communication. And yet, after I retired from American Express and came to Romania, I found myself afflicted with the same disease. And just to show you a little bit of show and tell, perhaps if I could do that, we needed a brochure. Just to tell people about the university. So I got on my little desktop and produced something in Microsoft Word, and then I went to our friendly local printer and got them to typeset it. And I thought, well, we can't afford color, so we'll just do the best we can with what we've got. And this was the result, which is okay. It does the job, but it doesn't do a very good job. Just pass them around. If you would just take a glance at it, you don't need to read it, but you just get the feel of it from the brochure itself. It's doing it on the cheap, and that's what I did. I should know better. 2 years later, when it came out, I was so disappointed with the result. It was unimpressive, had no impact on the reader. It told the story, yes, but that's about it. So 2 years later, we still didn't have anything. So next time around, what I did was I decided we would ask a designer to do it. And so I went to a Christian guy that I know who offered his time for free. He said he would charge us for studio photos and so on that had to be taken, but he would give his time for free, and he produced this. If you'd just like to pass that around. And that's professional. What a difference it makes, doesn't it? What a difference it makes. I mean, he knows what he's doing. Now, of course, it's colour, so that cost us quite a bit more in printing, but not as much more as you might have thought. It was about twice as much as the original one. For something about 100 times better. So, the moral of the story is, don't just go for the cheap option. Think about how we can do it well. That doesn't mean we have to go for the expensive option, but we have to go for the high quality option, the one that cares a bit about how we look. So, some thoughts, letterheads and stationery, publications, your website, if you haven't got one, you ought to have one. What does it look like? What's your physical environment look like? Try walking into your offices, your organization's office, and ask yourself, what does the outsider see when they walk in here? Does it need a coat of paint? Are there tatty notices hanging up on the notice board? What does it look like? Does it smell nice? Ask yourself, what's the impact? Mistake number 8. If you fell under a bus tomorrow, which God forbid, who would take over from you in your role? This is Nick's point, isn't it? When you got sick, who was going to take over? What was going to happen? Do you know what would happen in your organization? Do you care? Well, we may have no immediate plans for stopping doing what we're doing, but that's not actually a reason for not trying to find somebody who could take our place if necessary. Somebody who could succeed us as a leader. You see, the big mistake is for leaders to think that because it's a difficult problem, they won't actually deal with it right now. I suggest that we have a primary responsibility to the organizations that we lead to ensure that if we do fall under a bus, or perhaps more realistically, have a stroke, have a heart attack, or simply a nervous breakdown, that somebody is there to pick up the pieces and to ensure that the show goes on. Now, of course, it could be that you have a second in command, a deputy who could pick up the role and could maintain it and keep going, the vision, the one who would keep going along the tracks that you have designed. Most people could probably identify a caretaker who would look after the role. But that's not the same as having a successor, necessarily. Because a successor is somebody who would have the vision and the capability and the motivation to take the organization in the direction that it will need to go in the future, who will be prepared, if necessary, to change the direction from which you've been going, who has the capability and creativity and initiative to do it, if necessary. So as leaders, we need to be able to identify and prepare a successor. The problem is we often... Yes, sir?
I was just going to mention a good Heibel's quote.
Yeah.
Heibel said, you don't judge a ministry on the basis of what it looks like when the leader's in place, but judge what happens to it after he's gone.
When the leader leaves. Yeah. If it crumbles, it sounds like the work of a man. Now, the problem is that also as Christians, we tend to say, well, I'll just leave it to the Lord to worry about. The thing is, if he has called us to be professional leaders of an organization, then he's also called us to think about succession planning and to think about what we would do in the event that he takes us out of that role. Often, people fight shy of doing it because they can't see anybody around who could do the job. Well, true, in a small organization there probably isn't much management depth that you can immediately find somebody. But in that case, we've probably got to think about bringing somebody from the outside and asking ourselves, what job could they do in the organization? Somebody who's got more potential than just the job we hire them for, so that they can, at some point, be a suitable successor. The second thing is that so often we feel slightly threatened by a good person because they kind of encroach on where we are. They want responsibility. Maybe they push us a bit. Well, actually, that's the best thing that we could be looking for. That's exactly what we need. Sometimes a challenge in that situation to keep that person on board, because if we don't give them the responsibilities and the growth, then they won't stay. So again, a further challenge. We need to keep them interested and excited and committed so that if we do crumble, they'll be there. That part, I guess, is in the Lord's hands, a significant amount of it. Well, if you analyze it, the questions are obvious. Have you got somebody? If not, you need to do something about it. What can you do? I've given you some suggestions. If you can't find somebody, keep looking. Finally, as you say, thank the Lord. Mistake number 9, which is what they don't teach you at the Harvard Business School. Despite what I've been saying here for the last hour, I want to tell you that you cannot just rely on management techniques to get you through and to make your organization prosper. Of course, those things do help. I wouldn't be talking about them if I didn't believe in them and believe firmly in them. But I want to urge you to think about them just as weapons in your armory and not as the whole point. They're no substitute for really effective, spiritual, godly leadership. solidly based on prayer, guided by the Holy Spirit, and bearing the fruit of the Spirit in daily life. A few suggestions here. A sense of proportion. And that means we have to look from time to time at the real value of exactly what it is we're doing. If the main part of your day is being spent in basic administration, then perhaps you've got the management part of the job out of line with the vision. It's time to get back to the real purpose of why you are where you are. As the old saying goes, it's hard to remember that the real mission was to drain the swamp when you're up to your rear end in alligators. Secondly, keep a sense of humor and of the ridiculous. Do remember from time to time to laugh at yourself and the people around you about the way that you do things. We can get into the habit of taking ourselves and everything we do much too seriously. I think one of the most successful speakers in Christian circles in the UK is a man called Adrian Plass. He's incredibly funny because he sees just how ridiculous we Christians can be at times. He's a devoted and committed Christian himself. But the great thing about him is that he never mocks the Lord, but he's great at mocking Christian people mercilessly. And the Lord knows that we need it. Third, it helps to keep a sense of godly dissatisfaction. What that means is basically we can't afford to get complacent. That so often we strive for a goal and we finally get there and then we relax and say we got it, we did it, we made it. All over. Curtain. Well, there's nothing wrong with celebrating and rejoicing that something's gone well and praising God for how it went. There's everything right about that. But at that point, to lie back on our laurels and think that that's the end, that the battle's over, is self-deceiving. Much better if we celebrate and then, next day, start asking questions like, how could we have done it better? What can we learn from this in order to make sure that it goes more effectively next time? That we extend our reach further? When we've filled our morning service at church, there's a temptation to say, right, we've done it. But how about a second morning service? How about a service in the afternoon and then another in the evening and then maybe a second one in the evening? If we can stop ourselves from getting complacent and moving ourselves forward, what a difference it will make. And that's what godly dissatisfaction is. And finally, of course, the Christian's secret weapons. Prayer, brothers and sisters to talk things over with, and a servant leader's attitude of humility, not thinking ourselves better than other people. I'm constantly taken by surprise at the blessing of being a leader in Christian organizations. I hope you are too. That doesn't mean that we get it all right. We make mistakes, inevitably. I thought, hopefully, by showing some of the mistakes that we are prone to making, what a friend of mine calls the via negativa, the wrong way, that it can help us to think about things in the right way and put some things right in our lives that maybe have been going in the wrong direction. Let's stop there. I'll just, let me close with this passage from Proverbs 2. Proverbs 2, 6 to 11 says this: the Lord gives wisdom, and from his mouth come knowledge and understanding. He holds victory in store for the upright. He's a shield to those whose walk is blameless, for he guards the course of the just and protects the way of his faithful ones. Then you will understand what is right and just and fair, every good path. For wisdom will enter your heart, and knowledge will be pleasant to your soul. Discretion will protect you, and understanding will guard you. Amen. May it be so. Want to stand up? Now, folks, I've probably exhausted you at this point, so I'm very glad to quit here, if you like. But if you have questions or comments or things that you want to disagree with, please feel free to do so. Sit down and we'll take as long as you want up until 10 past 1, at which point we'll make a break for lunch. But if you want to go now, we can do that too. Over to you. Yes, ones that I've found useful. Peter Drucker is, well known, managing non-profit organisations. That is really a textbook. It's a series of conversations and questions. It's not very well structured, but it's got brilliant insights. And so for that reason, I would recommend it personally. The John Cotter, the Max Dupree and the Daryl Connor are all good stuff for... Really what I'm saying here is think again about how we lead.
Many of the principles that you've given here are... they appear to be addressing, say, overusage or... overusage of people who really have who we would say they're a natural leader. I mean, you think of a certain personality type and so forth. But in Christian leadership, it has been my experience that there are a whole bunch of people that it's the other problem. It's the Saul problem rather than someone being too eager. In the business world, that usually doesn't happen, unless it's a private corporation, because boards don't go. But in the Christian world, that seems to happen quite frequently.
The sort of underleading is what I hear you say. The question is, often in a Christian organization, we get underleading as opposed to the overleading or the extremes, which are some of the cases that I talked about here. Certainly, I think that is true. People not recognizing that as a leader, they have certain obligations. Nick and I probably talked quite a lot about the overly authoritarian leader, but there's also the kind of underly, the person who won't take responsibility, won't take decisions, who's just wants to be nice to everybody, certainly. We could add that as a tenth management mistake, essentially, yes. The failure to recognize that we have responsibilities as leaders is the commonest thing there. I don't know why we do that. I suppose because we want that we need to do everything with love, and we think of that as being soft and gentle in everything. We want to follow Jesus in being meek, but we fail to note that he was very clear and very firm at times with his disciples, that he was very outspoken at times. He called Peter Satan. That's pretty outspoken. So, it is certainly a problem in Christian circles. Not so much in other ones, but yes, we do get that. Thank you. Good comment. I'm sorry.
I came into Christian work about 18 months ago.
So yes, Steve.
One of the biggest differences I noticed is that all that happens then is things fester.
A failure to sort of take a grip on things. A failure to confront. Effectively, yeah. Present pleasure, future pain. Yeah. I've certainly found that.
There's a common attitude which I found, because I'm coming from quite a secular environment, as your management techniques, using business and values in business are no pointed that over and over. Instead of using those techniques and add on the Christian aspect to it, it's replaced. I mean, these techniques are replaced with something that's, Christian.
What we perceive as Christian values, which sort of replace it.
It's not like that. I mean, it's some interesting match of things. Some merger of biblical principles and emotions and things like that. And if it's not combined with formal management techniques, that's what I'm saying, it's my experience.
Yeah.
Then we're not going to be far. That's what I found.
Yeah. Just for the sake of the microphone, let me just. What you're saying is that your experience is similarly that people in Christian organisations don't apply.
There's an anxiety from formal management techniques.
Yeah.
Formal education, really.
Yes, I think that's true. So it's partly a lack of awareness, or maybe a lack of training, lack of experience sometimes, lack of teaching from superiors that will do that. How will we know if we are not taught? Most of these things are not instinctive. Some people will do very good things instinctively, but most of us need to be taught them. And so, yes, we need to. So it's both formal education and also passing on, teaching from boss to subordinate, from mentor to protege or whatever. Thank you.
But were you also saying that you felt there was a fear of the professional techniques?
Oh, yeah, this anxiety. It's as if we are something, we're someone who knew better on how to lead. They are the secular. Yeah.
People fight shy of these things because they perceive them to be hard-edged.
This ideology that is creating the wall between the knowledge itself.
Yeah.
The amateur's comment, yes.
Yes, indeed. Thank you.
Yeah. A comment and a question, also in the same line of this last discussion. I find that sometimes we attempt to substitute management and strategic planning for good relationships, good biblical relationships and organization. We sense that something's not right in the body, and we think we can solve it by bringing a new plan, which tastes like metal and oil, and it really doesn't solve the plan at all. What if there's something underneath in the church that's going on, poor relationships, non-biblical relationships, some spiritual thing that's going on, it's not going to resolve by a strategic plan. But the thing I wanted to ask you about is to see whether or not you've seen this. In our organization, we do a lot of strategic planning. And in our rapidly changing context, we are even now talking in terms of rolling strategic plans. We used to ask our workers for a 10-year plan and then a 5-year plan and a 1-year plan, but now we don't even talk in terms of that. We talk about a constantly changing, rolling strategic plan because we live in such a highly changing environment. But I find that with all the constantly analyzing and criticizing and questioning and trying to adapt to our changing environment, that it's like we're continually pulling the plant out of the pot, looking at the roots to see if it's doing okay.
Yep.
And in fact, we're killing it. And I wonder if you see any of this. So you talked earlier, one of your first points was you have to have people around who are able to question and to call into question your assumptions and this type of thing. But I wonder if there's also the side of, in this environment, sometimes we just need to settle down and go with something that's fundamental and good and give it time and relax a little bit. I don't know. I mean, I'm just struggling with that.
Really, the issue here that is whether it makes sense to keep on digging up your strategy as you say, pull it up by the roots to take a look at it. It just never quite gets a chance to grow. I absolutely agree with that. But from the point of view of a strategic plan, I don't think strategic plans should be dug up every month or every year. I think they need to be set, because that's the very nature of a strategic plan, they'll be set for a period 3 years out, let's say. The world's changing too fast for 10-year strategic plans, probably. But then your more tactical plans, the one-year stuff, needs to be geared to that strategy. I would have thought that was the essence of strategic planning. Now, we've got Jerry, who's the guru of strategic planning. What would your comment be, Jerry, here? You may disagree if you wish.
Well, it seems, I'm not sure that I'm prepared to really answer that question right now. I think, obviously, planning is, you know, significantly important. I think, you know, so many organizations don't have a clear idea in terms of where it is they're going. And I think there's a lot that's called strategic planning, which isn't really strategic at all. You know, a plan needs to be born out of, you know, who it is you are, what it is, as an organization you're committed to doing in terms of your mission. And it needs to be driven by a vision for what that mission looks like if it's fully accomplished.
Yeah.
And it needs to be quantifiable. And I think that's, in terms of you know, pulling it out and looking at the roots, I think the reason why someone might essentially do that would be to determine whether or not, you know, things are being accomplished, which can be accomplished in other ways. I think a lot of things that are called strategic plans are really nothing more than good ideas.
Yeah.
I mean, here we want to be, and, you know, and everybody, we share that in the context that this is our plan, when in reality, if you don't have it quantified out in terms of what it is that needs to happen this year, next year, and the years thereafter, it's kind of a neat idea, but the likelihood of that happening, you know, it's pretty unlikely and probably would justify somebody pulling it out and see if something's happening to something that really hasn't been defined in the first place.
We do have some sessions on strategic planning, so perhaps we could come back to some of this later. So I think your first point that we can get bound up with the management techniques and abandon the issues that relate to spiritual problems or spiritual issues, trying to solve them with management techniques will not do the job. I agree with that completely. How about calling it a day? Thank you very much for your attention.
But it's worth picking up. It's a good one.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll bear it in mind.
John, we're supposed to meet today.
Because we are.
Yes, and what time and where?
Well, let's meet with Nick. This is Igor.
Здравствуйте. Как у вас дела?
Хорошо.
You guys can talk.
Yeah, we can talk. This is holy language, Russian. Yes. What time?
Oh, thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Forget it.
Yeah, lovely. Thank you. I remember we talked last year. Were you here last year?
Latvia. Yes. Oh, you are not
Thanks.
Russian.
Then. No, but my name is Russian. Yes.
Yeah.
And I have a father in Russian.
Do Latvians willingly speak Russian?
Oh, not anymore. But I'm coming from that generation, which kind of went through school.
Yes.
It's easier.
Because it's interesting in Romania, lots and lots of people learned Russian. But these days say they don't speak a word of it.
Yeah, that's similar now.
I think it's more a matter of will than a matter of...
It is.
Anything else. They don't want to speak Russian.
Romanians will face another challenge. My wife has delivered a lecture in full forgiveness. She's using part of the illustrations from Martin Kendall's book.
Yes.
In Central and Eastern Europe have to go first as individuals, then as nations to repent and forgive. And once forever.
Yep.
To get free. Yep. Otherwise, we'll live forever with bitterness.
Yeah. I'm not sure how much bitterness. I'm not sure how much bitterness still remains, Nick.
Yeah, that's Romanians. We get Romanians are still very hard.
Do you think so? Do you think against Hungarians? Yes. I thought yes, indeed. Yeah, that's true. It's not as bad as it was. I don't think.
I think it's getting better.
I think it is.
Still,
it's not vanished.
Even
in really?
Oh yes.
Yes, I've come across one or two.
In particular,
I've come across one or two instances, but not many.
The fact is, they have been together, one Baptist Union, until the changes. Then the Hungarian speaking decide to believe, and the Romanians were not happy. No. Anyway, it's wonderful that Latvia, Litva, Estonia.
Let's go and pick up our lunch bags now, and then how about giving ourselves a 15-minute break till 1:30? We pick up our bags and we just go and find a table downstairs. There's lots of tables. We can just sit down there and do it. Hey? Thank you, Nick.